lovely show for you today. Lots of nice things happening. Last week we talked a little bit about radio dramas on our radio drama show, and we played an example of what that used to be back when the medium was relatively new. Radio broadcasts, such as we recognize them today, only started really around 1920, and we were taking a look at content from the late 1930s. All right, so moving on. Today I want to talk about another spoken word medium that's even more participatory in this day and age. I want to talk a little bit about audiobooks. There are a number of interesting audiobooks out there. You've probably seen them in bookstores, your favorite celebrities or actors reading books. There are some wonderful commercial-based websites that sell such readings, such as Silk Sound Books, which has some very excellent readings out there. There are also, however, involving audiobooks, an interesting and, in this day and age, fairly unique opportunity that is being presented. I'm certain that many people out there know of Project Gutenberg, and on Project Gutenberg, they have a push to create public domain, community-created audiobooks of as much of their content as they can. And they're not the only ones that do. I want to also mention LibriVox. That is LibriVox.org. They also are creators of public domain audiobooks. They don't just create them, though. This isn't a professional organization that just sits down and produces these things for us to passively receive. No. What they're doing is they're accepting submissions. If anybody out there would like to cut their teeth on doing voiceover for an audiobook, here's your chance. They're looking for volunteers, and so you're not going to become filthy rich, but this is a wonderful way in order to contribute to human knowledge. You want to have your voice preserved as an audiobook reader? Well, LibriVox and Project Gutenberg were both going to give you that very chance. All you have to do is contact them, and they will set it up. And I've noticed by going through the audio files that are created, they have some very spiffy engineers that will clean up what you do. So, which is something that you always have to do. Post-production is a very big thing. If you sit in front of a microphone, you will notice that. And it's not going to be very expensive for you to start out. A lot of these things can be done with, if you own a computer, that's most of what you need, free audio recording software, and a USB mic that will record yourself very fairly clearly, and you're set to go. A lot of the files I downloaded are mono. You don't have to worry about spending hundreds of dollars on a microphone. You don't have to worry about spending hundreds of dollars on software. On this day and age, it is not necessary. So the bar for participation is kind of low. And I'm saying this is a good thing because it means that anybody can participate. So if you want to participate but don't have access to a professional recording studio, well, that's no longer a hurdle. Go on to LibriVox, go on to Project Gutenberg, and get yourself involved. So what does this kind of stuff sound like? What does it mean? I'm going to play today a couple of examples of LibriVox titles. I tried to choose a bit of a variety in terms of voices presented, in terms of content and the like. And to start off, we're going to take a look at something that is a intellectual property that's in the public domain, at least by both the United States and Canadian copyright rules. And it is also something that you might be familiar with because Disney spent $200 million making it into a movie last year. It's a movie that maybe Disney is not happy to be remembered for, but The Princess of Mars. That's a book by Edgar Rice Burroughs. And the book's 100th anniversary was actually last year. And they celebrated it by making it into a huge, huge movie. And then taking Mars out of the title because Hollywood seems to be superstitious about that. But that's a different story. So what we're going to take a look at then for our first piece here today on Skulls Hall is the LibriVox audiobook edition of a public domain text of, and I'll make sure I get the title right because it's been changed over the years, The Princess of Mars, because it's different. It's called John, the movie's called John Carter, and I'm sitting here thinking, no, don't call it that because that's not what the book's called. Okay, so right after a word or two, we're going to start in with A Princess of Mars.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Chapter 1 of A Princess of Mars. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Thomas Copeland. A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Chapter 1. On the Arizona Hills.
I am a very old man. How old I do not know. Possibly I am 100, possibly more, but I cannot tell, because I have never aged as other men, nor do I remember any childhood. So far as I can recollect, I have always been a man of about 30. I appear today as I did 40 years or more ago, and yet I feel that I cannot go on living forever, that some day I shall die the real death from which there is no resurrection. I do not know why I should fear death, I who have died twice and am still alive. But yet I have the same horror of it as you, who have never died. And it is because of this terror of death, I believe, that I am so convinced of my mortality. And because of this conviction, I have determined to write down the story of the interesting periods of my life and of my death. I cannot explain the phenomena. I can only set down here, in the words of an ordinary soldier of fortune, a chronicle of the strange events that befell me during the 10 years that my dead body lay undiscovered in an Arizona cave. I have never told this story, nor shall mortal man see this manuscript until after I have passed over for eternity. I know that the average human mind will not believe what it cannot grasp, and so I do not purpose being pilloried by the public, the pulpit, and the press, and held up as a colossal liar, when I am but telling the simple truths which some day science will substantiate. Possibly the suggestions which I gained upon Mars, and the knowledge which I can set down in this chronicle, will aid in an earlier understanding of the mysteries of our sister planet. Mysteries to you, but no longer mysteries to me. My name is John Carter. I am better known as Captain Jack Carter of Virginia. At the close of the Civil War, I found myself possessed of several $100,000, Confederate, and a captain's commission in the cavalry arm of an army which no longer existed, the servant of a state which had vanished with the hopes of the South. Masterless, penniless, and with my only means of livelihood, fighting, gone, I determined to work my way to the Southwest and attempt to retrieve my fallen fortunes in a search for gold. I spent nearly a year prospecting in company with another Confederate officer, Captain James K. Powell of Richmond. We were extremely fortunate, for late in the winter of 1865, after many hardships and privations, we located the most remarkable gold-bearing quartz vein that our wildest dreams had ever pictured. Powell, who was a mining engineer by education, stated that we had uncovered over $1 million worth of ore in a trifle over 3 months. As our equipment was crude in the extreme, we decided that one of us must return to civilization, purchase the necessary machinery, and return with a sufficient force of men properly to work the mine. As Powell was familiar with the country, as well as with the mechanical requirements of mining, we determined that it would be best for him to make the trip. It was agreed that I was to hold down our claim against the remote possibility of its being jumped by some wandering prospector. On March 3, 1866, Powell and I packed his provisions on two of our burros, and, bidding me goodbye, he mounted his horse and started down the mountainside toward the valley, across which led the first stage of his journey. The morning of Powell's departure was, like nearly all Arizona mornings, clear and beautiful. I could see him and his little pack animals picking their way down the mountainside toward the valley, and all during the morning I would catch occasional glimpses of them as they topped a hogback or came out upon a level plateau. My last sight of Powell was about 3 in the afternoon as he entered the shadows of the range of the opposite side of the valley. Some half-hour later, I happened to glance casually across the valley and was much surprised to note 3 little dots in about the same place I had last seen my friend and his 2 pack animals. I am not given to needless worrying, but the more I tried to convince myself that all was well with Powell, and that the dots I had seen on his trail were antelopes or wild horses, the less I was able to assure myself. Since we had entered the territory, we had not seen a hostile Indian, and we had, therefore, become careless in the extreme, and were wont to ridicule the stories we had heard of the great number of these vicious marauders that were supposed to haunt the trails, taking their toll in lives and torture of every white party which fell into their merciless clutches. Powell, I knew, was well armed and, further, an experienced Indian fighter, but I, too, had lived and fought for years among the Sioux in the north, and I knew that his chances were small against a party of cunning trailing Apaches. Finally, I could endure the suspense no longer, and arming myself with my 2 Colt revolvers and a carbine, I strapped 2 belts of cartridges about me, and catching my saddle horse, started down the trail taken by Powell in the morning. As soon as I reached comparatively level ground, I urged my mount into a canter, and continued this, where the going permitted, until, close upon dusk, I discovered the point where other tracks joined those of Powell. They were the tracks of unshod ponies, 3 of them, and the ponies had been galloping. I followed rapidly until, darkness shutting down, I was forced to await the rising of the moon, and given an opportunity to speculate on the question of the wisdom of my chase. Possibly I had conjured up impossible dangers, like some nervous old housewife, and, when I should catch up with Powell, would get a good laugh for my pains. However, I am not prone to sensitiveness, and the following of a sense of duty, wherever it may lead, has always been a kind of fetish with me throughout my life, which may account for the honors bestowed upon me by 3 republics, and the decorations and friendships of an old and powerful emperor, and several lesser kings, in whose service my sword has been red many a time. About 9 o'clock, the moon was sufficiently bright for me to proceed on my way, and I had no difficulty in following the trail at a fast walk, and in some places at a brisk trot, until, about midnight, I reached the waterhole where Powell had expected to camp. I came upon the spot unexpectedly, finding it entirely deserted, with no signs of having been recently occupied as a camp. I was interested to note that the tracks of the pursuing horsemen, for such I was now convinced they must be, continued after Powell with only a brief stop at the hole for water, and always at the same rate of speed as his. I was positive now that the trailers were Apaches, and that they wished to capture Powell alive for the fiendish pleasure of the torture. So I urged my horse onward at a most dangerous pace, hoping against hope that I would catch up with the red rascals before they attacked him. Further speculation was suddenly cut short by the faint report of 2 shots far ahead of me. I knew that Powell would need me now, if ever, and I instantly urged my horse to his topmost speed up the narrow and difficult mountain trail. I had forged ahead for perhaps 1 mile or more without hearing further sounds, when the trail suddenly debouched into a small open plateau near the summit of the pass. I had passed through a narrow overhanging gorge just before entering suddenly upon this tableland, and the sight which met my eyes filled me with consternation and dismay. The little stretch of level land was white with Indian teepees, and there were probably 6,000 red warriors clustered around some object near the center of the camp. Their attention was so wholly riveted to this point of interest that they did not notice me, and I easily could have turned back into the dark recesses of the gorge and made my escape with perfect safety. The fact, however, that this thought did not occur to me until the following day removes any possible right to a claim of heroism to which the narration of this episode might possibly otherwise entitle me. I do not believe that I am made of the stuff which constitutes heroes, because in all of the hundreds of instances that my voluntary acts have placed me face to face with death, I cannot recall a single one where any alternative step to that I took occurred to me until many hours later. My mind is evidently so constituted that I am subconsciously forced into the path of duty without recourse to tiresome mental processes. However that may be, I have never regretted that cowardice is not optional with me. In this instance, I was, of course, positive that Powell was the center of attraction, but whether I thought or acted first, I do not know. But within an instant, from the moment the scene broke upon my view, I had whipped out my revolvers and was charging down upon the entire army of warriors, shooting rapidly and whooping at the top of my lungs. Single-handed, I could not have pursued better tactics, for the red men, convinced by sudden surprise that not less than a regiment of regulars was upon them, turned and fled in every direction for their bows, arrows, and rifles. The view which their hurried routing disclosed filled me with apprehension and with rage. Under the clear rays of the Arizona moon lay Powell, his body fairly bristling with the hostile arrows of the braves. That he was already dead, I could not but be convinced, and yet I would have saved his body from mutilation at the hands of the Apaches as quickly as I would have saved the man himself from death. Riding close to him, I reached down from the saddle, and, grasping his cartridge belt, drew him up across the withers of my mount. A backward glance convinced me that to return by the way I had come would be more hazardous than to continue across the plateau. So, putting spurs to my poor beast, I made a dash for the opening of the pass, which I could distinguish on the far side of the tableland. The Indians had by this time discovered that I was alone, and I was pursued with imprecations, arrows, and rifle balls. The fact that it is difficult to aim anything but imprecations accurately by moonlight, that they were upset by the sudden and unexpected manner of my advent, and that I was a rather rapidly moving target, saved me from the various deadly projectiles of the enemy, and permitted me to reach the shadows of the surrounding peaks before an orderly pursuit could be organized. My horse was traveling practically unguided, as I knew that I had probably less knowledge of the exact location of the trail to the pass than he, and thus it happened that he entered a defile which led to the summit of the range, and not to the pass which I had hoped would carry me to the valley and to safety. It is probable, however, that to this fact I owe my life, and the remarkable experiences and adventures which befell me during the following 10 years. My first knowledge that I was on the wrong trail came when I heard the yells of the pursuing savages suddenly grow fainter and fainter, far off to my left. I knew then that they had passed to the left of the jagged rock formation at the edge of the plateau, to the right of which my horse had borne me and the body of Powell. I drew rein on a little level promontory overlooking the trail below and to my left, and saw the party of pursuing savages disappearing around the point of a neighboring peak. I knew the Indians would soon discover that they were on the wrong trail, and that the search for me would be renewed in the right direction as soon as they located my tracks. I had gone but a short distance further when what seemed to be an excellent trail opened up around the face of a high cliff. The trail was level and quite broad, and led upward, and in the general direction I wished to go. The cliff arose for several hundred feet on my right, and on my left was an equal and nearly perpendicular drop to the bottom of a rocky ravine. I had followed this trail for perhaps 100 yards when a sharp turn to the right brought me to the mouth of a large cave. The opening was about 4 feet in height and 3 to 4 feet wide, and at this opening the trail ended. It was now morning, and with the customary lack of dawn, which is a startling characteristic of Arizona, it had become daylight almost without warning. Dismounting, I laid Powell upon the ground. But the most painstaking examination failed to reveal the faintest spark of life. I forced water from my canteen between his dead lips, bathed his face and rubbed his hands, working over him continuously for the better part of an hour in the face of the fact that I knew him to be dead. I was very fond of Powell. He was thoroughly a man in every respect, a polished southern gentleman, a staunch and true friend. And it was with a feeling of the deepest grief that I finally gave up my crude endeavors at resuscitation. Leaving Powell's body where it lay on the ledge, I crept into the cave to reconnoiter. I found a large chamber, possibly 100 feet in diameter and 30 or 40 feet in height, a smooth and well-worn floor, and many other evidences that the cave had at some remote period been inhabited. The back of the cave was so lost in dense shadow that I could not distinguish whether there were openings into other apartments or not. As I was continuing my examination, I commenced to feel a pleasant drowsiness creeping over me, which I attributed to the fatigue of my long and strenuous ride, and the reaction from the excitement of the fight of the pursuit. I felt comparatively safe in my present location, as I knew that one man could defend the trail to the cave against an army. I soon became so drowsy that I could scarcely resist the strong desire to throw myself on the floor of the cave for a few moments' rest, but I knew that this would never do, as it would mean certain death at the hands of my red friends, who might be upon me at any moment. With an effort, I started toward the opening of the cave, only to reel drunkenly against a side wall, and from there slip prone upon the floor. End of chapter 1.
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
I'm using the power of the internet to access the World Wide Web on my laptop computer.
Looking for an upgrade? The UBC Bookstore has educationally priced computers and software, including the latest Apple, Lenovo, and more. A huge selection of laptop and tablet accessories competitively priced with the big box stores. Come by and check out the lowest priced Macs in Vancouver. The UBC Bookstore, where your purchases support your UBC campus.
On Friday, January 25th, come to Seymour Mountain for the Great Northern Concrete Toboggan Race, an annual event that challenges the creativity, innovation, and technical skills of engineering students from all across Canada. Participating teams must design and construct a toboggan with a metal frame and a running surface made completely out of concrete. For more information, go to gnctr2012.com.
And welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM. And that was the first chapter of The Princess of Mars. And you can see a couple of interesting things that are there. The idea of itself of preserving stories for others to be able to see and hear. It's a really, really good one. But it's an interesting one. I chose that in particular partially because of its odd content. It's the sort of thing that we as a civilization ought not to be proud of, but that we as a civilization ought not to forget. And so it straddles that line of, like, where does it fit to be able to talk about other sorts of people, First Nations people, using that kind of language, because our civilization is still founded upon it, whether we like it or not, and we really ought to, we have to be aware of its history in order to make changes for the better. I chose it, though, because, you see, Disney decided to, this is the property they were going to spend $200 million on in order to make a movie, and so that debate is still there. You know, this isn't the first time that Disney has used their cultural capital clout in order to do something of this nature. And, of course, it was excised, well, it's a great deal from the film, but it's still an issue. Like, that was the book they decided was worth a $200 million remake. But it is a pioneer story in the history of science fiction. Edgar Rice Burroughs was one of the first people to write science fiction. He was one from the very first generation of science fiction writers in the early 20th century with Jules Verne and the rest. And so we're going to move on to a different story from roughly the same time period, but this one was going to take us back to the British Isles. And we're going to be taking a look at the second chapter of A Picture of Dorian Gray. And this one is nice and offensive for all sorts of different reasons. This one is the, if you will, the seduction scene where Dorian Gray finally falls in a very real sense of the word. And I don't have time to go into all of the underlying stuff that's behind it, but I think that it is a worthwhile bit to check out as well. And so here in a moment on CITR 101.9 FM, we are going to have The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Entered, they saw Dorian Gray. He was seated at the piano with his back to them, turning over the pages of a volume of Schumann's Forest Scenes.
"You must lend me these, Basil," he cried. "I want to learn them. They're perfectly charming."
"That entirely depends on how you sit today, Dorian."
"Oh, I am tired of sitting.
I don't want a life-size portrait of myself," answered the lad, swinging round on the music stool in a willful, petulant manner. When he caught sight of Lord Henry, a faint blush colored his cheeks for a moment, and he started up.
"I beg your pardon, Basil, but I didn't know you had anyone with you."
"This is Lord Henry Wotton, Dorian, an old Oxford friend of mine. I have been telling him what a capital sitter you were, and now you've spoiled everything."
"You have not spoiled my pleasure in meeting you, Mr. Gray," said Lord Henry, stepping forward and extending his hand. "My aunt has often spoken to me about you. You are one of her favorites, and, I am afraid, one of her victims also."
"I am in Lady Agatha's black books at present," answered Dorian, with a funny look of petulance. "I promised to go to the club in Whitechapel with her last Tuesday, and I really forgot all about it. We were to have played a duet together, three duets, I believe. I don't know what she will say to me. I am far too frightened to call."
"Oh, I will make your peace with my aunt. She is quite devoted to you. And I don't think it really matters about your not being there. The audience probably thought it was a duet. When Aunt Agatha sits down to the piano, she makes quite enough noise for two people."
"That's very horrid to her, and not very nice to me," answered Dorian, laughing.
Lord Henry looked at him. Yes, he was certainly wonderfully handsome, with his finely curved scarlet lips, his frank blue eyes, his crisp golden hair. There was something in his face that made one trust him at once. All of the candor of youth was there, as well as a youth's passionate purity. One felt that he kept himself unspotted from the world. No wonder Basil Hallward worshipped him.
"You are too charming to go in for philanthropy, Mr. Gray. Far too charming."
And Lord Henry flung himself down on the divan and opened a cigarette case. The painter had been busy mixing his colors and getting his brushes ready. He was looking worried, and when he heard Lord Henry's last remark, he glanced at him, hesitated for a moment, and then said,
"Harry, I want to finish this picture today. Would you think it awfully rude of me if I asked you to go away?"
Lord Henry smiled and looked at Dorian Gray.
"Am I to go, Mr. Gray?" he asked.
"Oh, please don't, Lord Henry. I see that Basil is in one of his sulky moods, and I can't bear him when he sulks. Besides, I want you to tell me why I shouldn't go in for philanthropy."
"I don't know if I should tell you that, Mr. Gray. It is so tedious a subject that one would have to talk seriously about it. But I certainly shall not run away, now that you have asked me to stop. You don't really mind, do you, Basil? You have often told me that you like your sitters to have someone to talk to."
Hallward bit his lip.
"If Dorian wishes it, then of course you may stay. Dorian's whims are lost to everybody except himself."
Lord Henry took up his hat and gloves.
"You are very pressing, Basil, but I am afraid I must go. I have promised to meet a man at the Orleans. Goodbye, Mr. Gray. Come and see me some afternoon on Curzon Street. I am nearly always home at 5 o'clock. Write to me when you are coming. I shall be sorry to miss you."
"Basil," cried Dorian Gray, "if Lord Henry Wotton goes, then I shall go too. You never open your lips while you are painting, and it is horribly dull sitting on a platform trying to look pleasant. Ask him to stay, I insist on it."
"Stay, Harry, to oblige Dorian, and to oblige me," said Hallward, gazing intently at his picture. "It is quite true, I never talk when I am working, and never listen either, and it must be dreadfully tedious for my unfortunate sitters. I beg you to stay."
"But what about my man at the Orleans?"
The painter laughed. "I don't think there'll be any difficulty about that. Sit down again, Harry. And now, Dorian, get up on the platform, and don't move around too much or pay attention to what Lord Henry says. He has a very bad influence over all of his friends, with the single exception of myself."
Dorian Gray stepped up onto the dais with the air of a young Greek martyr and made a little moue of discontent to Lord Henry, to whom he had rather taken a fancy. He was so unlike Basil. They made a delightful contrast. He had such a beautiful voice. After a few minutes, he asked him,
"Have you really had a very bad influence, Lord Henry, as Basil says?"
"There is no such thing as good influence, Mr. Gray. All influence is immoral. Immoral from the scientific point of view."
"Why?"
"Because to influence a person is to give him one's own soul. He does not think his natural thoughts or burn with his natural passions. His virtues are not real to him. His sins, if there are such things as sins, are borrowed. He becomes an echo of someone else's music, an actor of a part that has not been written for him. The aim of life is self-development. To realize one's nature perfectly, that is what each of us is here for. People are afraid of themselves nowadays. They have forgotten the highest of all duties, the duty that one owes to oneself. Of course they are charitable. They feed the hungry, they clothe the beggar, but their own souls starve and are naked. Courage has gone out of our race. Perhaps we never really had it. The terror of society, which is the basis of morals, the terror of God, which is the secret of religion, these are the two things that govern us. And yet..."
"Just turn your head a little more to the right, Dorian, like a good boy," said the painter, deep in his work, and conscious only that a look had come into the lad's face he had never seen before.
"And yet," continued Lord Henry, in his low musical voice, and with that graceful wave of the hand that was always so characteristic of him, and that he had even in his Eton days, "I believe that if one man were to live out his life fully and completely, were to give form to every feeling, expression to every thought, reality to every dream, I believe the world would gain such a fresh impulse of joy that we would forget all of the maladies of medievalism and return to the Hellenic ideal, to something finer, richer than the Hellenic ideal, it may be. But the bravest man amongst us is afraid of himself. The mutilation of the savage has its tragic survival in the self-denial that mars our lives. We are punished for our refusals. Every impulse that we strive to strangle broods in the mind and poisons us. The body sins once and has done with its sin, for action is a mode of purification. Nothing remains then but the recollection of a pleasure or the luxury of a regret. The only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it. Resist it, and your soul grows sick with longing for things it has forbidden to itself. With desire for what its monstrous laws have made monstrous and unlawful. It has been said that the great events of the world take place in the brain. It is in the brain, and the brain only, that the great sins of the world take place also. You, Mr. Gray, you yourself, with your rose-red mouth and your rose-white boyhood, you have had passions that have made you afraid. Thoughts that have filled you with terror. Daydreams and sleeping dreams whose mere memory might stain your cheek with shame.
Stop, faltered Dorian Gray. Stop, you bewilder me. I don't know what to say. There is some answer to you, but I cannot find it. Don't speak. Let me think, or rather, let me try not to think.
For nearly 10 minutes he stood there, motionless, with parted lips, and eyes strangely bright. He was dimly conscious that entirely fresh influences were at work within him. Yet they seemed to him to have come really from himself. The few words that Basil's friend had said to him, words spoken by chance, no doubt, and with willful paradox in them, had touched some secret chord that had never been touched before, but that he felt now vibrating and throbbing to certain pulses. Music had stirred him like that. Music had troubled him many times, but music was not articulate. It was not a new world, but rather another chaos that it created in us. Words. Mere words. How terrible they were. How clear and vivid and cruel. One could not escape from them. And yet, what a subtle magic there was in them. They seemed to be able to give a plastic form to formless things, and to have a music of their own as sweet as that of the viol or of the lute. Mere words. Was there anything so real as words? Yes. There had been things in his boyhood that he had not understood. He understood them now. Life suddenly became fiery-colored to him. It seemed to him that he had been walking in fire. Why had he not known it? With a subtle smile, Lord Henry watched him. He knew the precise psychological moment when to say nothing. He felt intensely interested. He was amazed at the sudden impression his words had produced, and, remembering a book he had read when he was 16, a book which had revealed to him much he had not known before, he wondered whether Dorian Gray was passing through a similar experience. He had merely shot an arrow into the air. Had it hit a mark? How fascinating the lad was. Hallward painted away with that marvelous bold touch of his, that had the true refinement and perfect delicacy that, in art at any rate, comes only from strength. He was unconscious of the silence.
"Basil, I am tired of standing," cried Dorian Gray suddenly. "I must go out into the garden. The air in here is stifling."
"My dear fellow, I'm so sorry. When I am painting, I can't think of anything else. But you never sat better. You were perfectly still, and I have caught the effect I wanted, the half-parted lips, the bright look in the eyes. I don't know what Lord Henry has been saying to you, but he has certainly made you the most wonderful expression. I suppose he's been paying you compliments. You mustn't believe a word that he says."
"He has certainly not been paying me compliments. Perhaps that is the reason that I don't believe anything he has told me."
"You know, you believe it all," said Lord Henry, looking at him with his dreamy, languorous eyes. "I will go out in the garden with you. It is horribly hot in the studio. Basil, let us have something iced to drink. Something with strawberries in it."
Hey, Horace, give us 3 shots of your best bourbon. And have that Russian waiter I like bring it over.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Russian Tim, and I'm the host of weekly punk rock radio show called Rocket from Russia. Tune into CITR 101.9 FM every Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m. And you can also find the podcast on CITR.ca, iTunes, and my blog, rocketfromrussia.tumblr.com.
And welcome back to the live segment of us here on Scald's Hall at CITR 101.9 FM. And that was the seduction scene from Chapter 2 of A Picture of Dorian Gray. And yes, it's something I read. And I read it with a slightly different sensibility than the previous reader, probably because most of the acting training I do is for voiceover work, and we kind of just chew the scenery like nobody's business, which is a lot of fun, but it means you read a lot slower. And so I got through like half the material in the same amount of time. But we're going to be moving on, and we're going to be taking a look at our final reading for the day in just a moment, but I just want to mention a couple of upcoming events. Next week, our show next week will be on Friday, January 25th. Friday, January 25th. That day, January 25th, is Robert Burns Day. And for anybody who doesn't know, Robert Burns is the official poet of Scotland. And we're going to be able to celebrate Robbie Burns Day with a very special treat. Next day... On our radio program here, we're going to have 2 poets, not one, but 2 poets. We're going to have Carl Lego and Kedrick James. They have agreed to be on our show at the same time, and they're going to be giving us some of their great poems. That's going to be a real treat, and that's going to really be awesome. And so we're going to be having them on the show next week. And in the upcoming weeks, we're going to be having several other guests as well. The Wolf Mountain Clan, whose work was not featured on the show, but mentioned and put up on our social media feeds. They're going to be featured on the show at long last. We are going to have at least 1, possibly 2, guest spots for them coming up in the upcoming weeks. We're also going to be having other people involved in the creative writing department who have individually agreed to be on the show, and many other things as well. Next month, we might have a very special treat as well, something that I'm not going to give away right now because I cannot guarantee it, but let's just say that it will be very, very great, and it will involve the fan-built project, which is something, if you haven't checked out yet, you really ought to. The fan-built project is, in short, a sort of cottage industry for making animation. If you like to animate, if you like to do music, if you like to do voiceover work, if you like to do anything that a cartoon might need to have done in order to make a cartoon, you can collaborate through the FanBuild website and put together everything you need in order to create an enjoyable finished product for the world to enjoy. And this is just getting off the ground just now. Their official launch was last month. They're still getting the bits and bobs of the websites up and going. But this is something that is big and starting. And so for those of you out there who might want to be interested, you ought to check them out. FanBuilt, F-A-N-B-U-I-L-T. And if we're very lucky, we're going to be able to talk to people involved in that project in the next month. They're going to be doing a lot of... they're based here in Vancouver, and they're going to be covering a lot of local media in the upcoming months. So our final reading for today, so that we have time to cover it, will be one of Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales. And I think you will enjoy it as much as I did. Enjoy.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Kara Schallenberg, www.kray.org. Andersen's Fairy Tales by Hans Christian Andersen. The Emperor's New Clothes. Many years ago there was an emperor who was so excessively fond of new clothes that he spent all his money in dress. He did not trouble himself in the least about his soldiers, nor did he care to go either to the theater or the chase, except for the opportunities then afforded him for displaying his new clothes. He had a different suit for each hour of the day, and, as of any other king or emperor, one is accustomed to say, "He is sitting in council." It was always said of him, "The emperor is sitting in his wardrobe." Time passed merrily in the large town which was his capital. Strangers arrived every day at the court. One day, two rogues, calling themselves weavers, made their appearance. They gave out that they knew how to weave stuffs of the most beautiful colors and elaborate patterns, the clothes manufactured from which should have the wonderful property of remaining invisible to everyone who was unfit for the office he held, or who was extraordinarily simple in character. "These must indeed be splendid clothes," thought the emperor. "Had I such a suit, I might at once find out what men in my realms are unfit for their office, and also be able to distinguish the wise from the foolish. This stuff must be woven for me immediately." And he caused large sums of money to be given to both the weavers, in order that they might begin their work directly. So the two pretended weavers set up two looms, and affected to work very busily, though in reality they did nothing at all. They asked for the most delicate silk and the purest gold thread, put both into their own knapsacks, and then continued their pretended work at the empty looms until late at night. "I should like to know how the weavers are getting on with my cloth," said the emperor to himself, after some little time had elapsed. He was, however, rather embarrassed when he remembered that a simpleton, or one unfit for his office, would be unable to see the manufacture. To be sure, he thought he had nothing to risk in his own person, but yet he would prefer sending somebody else to bring him intelligence about the weavers and their work before he troubled himself in the affair. All the people throughout the city had heard of the wonderful property the cloth was to possess, and all were anxious to learn how wise or how ignorant their neighbors might prove to be. "I will send my faithful old minister to the weavers," said the emperor at last, after some deliberation. "He will be best able to see how the cloth looks, for he is a man of sense, and no one can be more suitable for his office than he is." So the faithful old minister went into the hall, where the knaves were working with all their might at their empty looms. "What can be the meaning of this?" thought the old man, opening his eyes very wide. "I cannot discover the least bit of thread on the looms." However, he did not express his thoughts aloud. The impostors requested him very courteously to be so good as to come nearer their looms, and then asked him whether the design pleased him, and whether the colors were not very beautiful, at the same time pointing to the empty frames. The poor old minister looked and looked. He could not discover anything on the looms, for a very good reason, viz., there was nothing there. "What?" thought he again. "Is it possible that I am a simpleton? I have never thought so myself, and no one must know it now if I am so. Can it be that I am unfit for my office? No, that must not be said either. I will never confess that I could not see the stuff." "Well, Sir Minister," said one of the knaves, still pretending to work, "you do not say whether the stuff pleases you." "Oh, it is excellent," replied the old minister, looking at the loom through his spectacles. "The pattern, and the colors, yes, I will tell the emperor without delay how very beautiful I think them." "We shall be much obliged to you," said the impostors, and then they named the different colors and described the pattern of the pretended stuff. The old minister listened attentively to their words, in order that he might repeat them to the emperor, and then the knaves asked for more silk and gold, saying that it was necessary to complete what they had begun. However, they put all that was given them into their knapsacks, and continued to work with as much apparent diligence as before at their empty looms. The emperor now sent another officer of his court to see how the men were getting on, and to ascertain whether the cloth would soon be ready. It was just the same with this gentleman as with the minister. He surveyed the looms on all sides, but could see nothing at all but the empty frames. "Does not the stuff appear as beautiful to you as it did to my lord the minister?" asked the impostors of the emperor's second ambassador, at the same time making the same gestures as before, and talking of the design and colors which were not there. "I certainly am not stupid," thought the messenger. "It must be that I am not fit for my good, profitable office. That is very odd. However, no one shall know anything about it." And accordingly he praised the stuff he could not see, and declared that he was delighted with both colors and patterns. "Indeed, please your Imperial Majesty," said he to his sovereign when he returned, "the cloth which the weavers are preparing is extraordinarily magnificent." The whole city was talking of the splendid cloth which the emperor had ordered to be woven at his own expense. And now the emperor himself wished to see the costly manufacture while it was still in the loom. Accompanied by a select number of officers of the court, among whom were the two honest men who had already admired the cloth, he went to the crafty impostors who, as soon as they were aware of the emperor's approach, went on working more diligently than ever, although they still did not pass a single thread through the looms. "Is not the work absolutely magnificent?" said the two officers of the crown already mentioned. "If your majesty will only be pleased to look at it, what a splendid design! What glorious colors!" And at the same time they pointed to the empty frames, for they imagined that everyone else could see this exquisite piece of workmanship. "How is this?" said the emperor to himself. "I can see nothing. This is indeed a terrible affair. Am I a simpleton, or am I unfit to be an emperor? That would be the worst thing that could happen. Oh, the cloth is charming," said he aloud. "It has my complete approbation." And he smiled most graciously, and looked closely at the empty looms, for on no account would he say that he could not see what two of the officers of his court had praised so much. All his retinue now strained their eyes, hoping to discover something on the looms, but they could see no more than the others. Nevertheless, they all exclaimed, "Oh, how beautiful!" and advised His Majesty to have some new clothes made from this splendid material for the approaching procession. "Magnificent! Charming! Excellent!" resounded on all sides, and everyone was uncommonly gay. The emperor shared in the general satisfaction, and presented the impostors with the riband of an order of knighthood, to be worn in their buttonholes, and the title of Gentlemen Weavers. The rogues sat up the whole of the night before the day on which the procession was to take place, and had 16 lights burning, so that everyone might see how anxious they were to finish the emperor's new suit. They pretended to roll the cloth off the looms, cut the air with their scissors, and sewed with needles without any thread in them. "See," cried they at last, "the emperor's new clothes are ready." And now the emperor, with all the grandees of his court, came to the weavers, and the rogues raised their arms, as if in the act of holding something up, saying, "Here are your majesty's trousers, here is the scarf, here is the mantle. The whole suit is as light as a cobweb. One might fancy one has nothing at all on when dressed in it. That, however, is the great virtue of this delicate cloth." "Yes, indeed," said all the courtiers, although not one of them could see anything of this exquisite manufacture. "If your Imperial Majesty will be graciously pleased to take off your clothes, we will fit on the new suit in front of the looking-glass." The emperor was accordingly undressed, and the rogues pretended to array him in his new suit, the emperor turning round from side to side before the looking-glass. How splendid His Majesty looks in his new clothes, and how well they fit! Everyone cried out. What a design! What colors! These are indeed royal robes! The canopy which is to be borne over Your Majesty in the procession is waiting, announced the chief master of the ceremonies. I am quite ready, answered the Emperor. Do my new clothes fit well? Asked he, turning himself round again before the looking-glass, in order that he might appear to be examining his handsome suit. The lords of the bedchamber, who were to carry His Majesty's train, felt about on the ground, as if they were lifting up the ends of the mantle, and pretended to be carrying something, for they would by no means betray anything like simplicity or unfitness for their office. So now the Emperor walked under his high canopy in the midst of the procession, through the streets of his capital, and all the people standing by and those at the windows cried out, "Oh, how beautiful are our Emperor's new clothes! What a magnificent train there is to the mantle, and how gracefully the scarf hangs!" In short, no one would allow that he could not see these much-admired clothes, because in doing so he would have declared himself either a simpleton or unfit for his office. Certainly none of the Emperor's various suits had ever made so great an impression as these invisible ones. "But the Emperor has nothing on at all," said a little child. "Listen to the voice of innocence!" exclaimed his father, and what the child had said was whispered from one to another.
All right, that will be it for us here at Skald's Hall at CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up next, we have Radio Zero by Tyler and Cam. So just stay tuned, hang on, and that will be coming up next. And that's all for us here on the Friday afternoon for Skald's Hall.